Good morning. Today is Tuesday, September the 15th. That stuff out there is called blue sky, if you're fortunate enough to be living on the coast. Joining us this morning, well, at least around Humboldt Bay on the coast. Can't speak for other parts, but around Humboldt Bay, hey, it's blue sky. Hooray, hooray. Joining us this morning is the UC Forest Advisor and Head Coordinator of the whole Marianne, Yana Valakovic. Good morning, lady.
Good morning, Brian.
Well, that might not be your official title, but it's your functional title. How's that?
Yeah, it works. It works. We'll go with it.
All right. Winston, why do we say it?
Since I'm in a Three Stooges morning, a feeling this morning, what is the origin of the word stooge?
Stooge.
I know it's not Moe, Larry, and Curly. They've got nothing to do with
stooge,
the answer.
Stooge.
You got me.
Yeah, I'm thinking it must maybe simpleton or imbecile or something like that. I mean, does it have to do with mental deficiency?
No.
Oh, okay. I lost. And obviously I'm practicing
it. It's got to be some profession that we don't know about.
Okay.
It's a theatrical term and was first used to designate a comedian's accomplice who was hidden in the audience. From the fact that his real identity and purpose was not known to the other members of the audience, he came to be called a stool pigeon, which, by Elysian, became stooge.
Okay. So an audience plant. See, it was really a botanical term that got horribly, horribly wrong. Oh, boy. So what are people asking you about, Yana, as far as forest and fuel load and things like that? Are you getting a lot of people asking about how come so many?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, less people from Humboldt County and more the broad mainstream media that's trying to digest and make sense of this set of, you know, horrific events. And you know, the questions have ranged from, is climate contributing to this? Should we be rebuilding? How do we get ourselves out of this? Is this the new normal? How do we move forward? How do we recover? Was there anything we could have done? Did we see this coming?
Oh, so it really sounds like
a little all over the map.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of them are from the concrete jungle and haven't been out in the woods too much, or have followed anything like timber practices and harvest plans and some of the discussions that we have here annually, pretty much for the last 100-150 years.
Well, I mean, I agree that if you have a propensity to, you know, been outside and looked around, you have a better understanding of these things. But I think, you know, the scale of the challenge, I think, is really coming home to roost. And I think a lot of people are really beginning to feel uncertain about what's happened and what's happened over the last decade. And should we extrapolate over the last decade towards the next decade? And, you know, where are we going in all of this moment? And I think feeling, you know, quite a bit overwhelmed by this, you know, the scale and the insufficient resources to respond to, you know, so many ignitions simultaneously across the entire West Coast.
There's no way we could have enough firefighters or manpower or whatever phraseology or title needs to be used to be able to combat this many fires or, you know, a major lightning storm coming through. I mean, you know, it just isn't attainable. So I think there's some kind of moderate point that says, okay, this is acceptable. We're going to have certain number, but we do have to be still prepared. We still need to educate the community. We still need to know how to react, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think you fall into one camp. There are a lot of folks out there that feel like we just haven't invested enough in fire and we just don't have enough fire resources. I tend to flip that a little bit and say, you know, there's the suppression side of the equation, but there's the prevention side of the equation.
Yeah.
And we keep putting all of our eggs in the suppression side of the equation, and that's not really, you know, solving our issues. It does in the acute moment, but it's not dealing with our chronic challenges. And if we don't start pivoting around prevention and mitigation, we can't just fight our way out of this.
What in a quick nutshell, because I'm sure we're going to open the nut here pretty quick. See, yeah, we just kind of flip into ag talk here really quickly.
Well, we're comfortable there. We all like to eat.
Is there a quick, simple, easy thought for prevention other than clear cut everything so there's nothing to burn, or have sprinklers, you know, sprinkle the forest? It's things that just truly aren't possible. When we say prevention, is it kind of like what the cops say, hardening the target, making it more difficult? Or is this trying to eliminate the potential opportunity for any fire of any magnitude?
Well, I think you're specifically talking about the fuel element.
Yes.
Prevention also encompasses a lot more issues, and maybe we should talk about those too. But, you know, on the fuel side, we live in the West Coast, which has deep soils, high productivity, you know, sufficient rain or precipitation to promote vegetation growth. So that cycle doesn't stop. We keep making fuel. The landscape keeps growing fuel. And that we can't ever, you know, we're not going to turn that process off. But what we can do is help, think at a much more integrated strategic level, where we start to think about our landscapes, and I'm going to use a term, instead of watersheds, like fire sheds, where, you know, we've built in sufficient systems to be able to mitigate oncoming wildfire, and when we need to, allow it to work within landscapes such that it doesn't cause, you know, full fanned kill, you know, where trees are in a position that they can be resilient to fire, that we've got heterogeneity, meaning that all the stands are not the same age, they're not all the same size, because then you just have what you call kind of fuel continuity. You know,
and we'll talk about, we'll pick up from there when we come back. It's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and The Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:23. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic. Jana, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the concept of fuel and fire. And you used a phrase that was first-time exposure for me, fuel continuity.
Right.
But it, as you were describing it, you have different ages of trees and of different species in the mix. Okay, that kind of makes a little bit of sense. But to get to that point, that's, I guess, where the discussion really starts to get heated up, so to speak. Is there an embracing of that concept of fuel continuity?
Well, I mean, yes, there's an embracing of the idea that different conditions create different opportunities. So, for example, right now in lots of our landscapes, we're getting more frequency of fire. And so you have this fire history component that can serve as buffers for future fires in the near term. So, you know, if a fire had gone through one area maybe 5 years ago, it's knocked down the brush, it's consumed some of the dead fuel, so the downed, logs and branches and such. And so, there's less fuel overall in that footprint. So when a new fire approaches it, you've already had quote unquote fuel treatment, and it's, you know, you can use that as a management point and an anchoring point to be able to do, to try and slow down the oncoming fire, for example. So that idea of discontinuity, sort of creating, different amounts of fuel, different amounts of, vegetation, different structures can be a problem, and it also can be a benefit when you're trying to think about strategic fire management. So what I'm getting at is this idea that we really do some integrated planning. We work with communities, and you know, because we're going to be doing cross-jurisdictional, cross-private-public partnerships, thinking and implementing action plans such that we're trying to be able to create a resilient future landscape that can tolerate the, you know, intrusion of fire, that can use prescribed fire to maintain certain stand characteristics that word today, as well as, you know, managing that fuel such that you've got the ability to kind of create the future stand that you want. If everything's the same, then everything's the same risk. So, you know, breaking that up, creating that complexity is, you know, kind of part of our future. And we're going to need to think about how the managed landscape fits in that, you know, how the interests of different owners fit into that. And, you know, how do we aggregate that in total so that we don't have 700,000 acre fires, for example.
When you say land owner, are you talking about the large landowner, the timber companies, the federal government, the state government, or are you talking about the Papsteins that have got 3 acres next to the Smiths that have got 3 acres, next to the Joneses that have got 3 acres?
Right, I'm talking about everybody. But we've got to have a vision about what we want to do and how that's going to come together. So if you're in the community of Weaverville, where you've got a mix of small owners, you've got industrial owners, you've got, you know, public forest managers, you've got a community forest, which is under an operational plan, which is owned by the federal government, but the community helps dictate that. How are you going to think about fire in Weaverville into the future? And how are you going to think about strategic management within Weaverville? And how do we create resilience both in the human community and the built environment, as well in the landscape? And that's the piece we haven't really gotten to, is creating that shared vision and that commitment to shared management.
It almost sounds like an HOA.
Well, I mean, kind of, but I think what we're missing right now in this moment is that articulation of what we want to achieve. And so you've got a lot of folks just working on their individual pieces, and sometimes it aggregates out to something collectively good, and sometimes it doesn't, right? And sometimes it's not enough. You know, the issue is that we've been just sort of assuming that we could catch every fire that comes at us, and the reality is that's not true. We've got so much built up backlog of down material, you know, thick shrubs, fans of various different ages, that there's just the capacity to burn, you know, in at least a 6 month time period. So you get a lightning series that comes through and you get, you know, tons and tons of ignitions. Of course you're going to be challenged with resource limitations, and of course you're not going to be able to get all of those events, and that's how you get the August complex, and that's how you get the Red Salmon complex. And, you know, it's stressing the system, but we haven't created a landscape that fire is manageable within that.
Is there any governmental entity that's currently allowing salvage harvesting on any scale large enough to not only be economically viable for somebody to go in and do it, but also to start to make the impact so that there's not a ton of dry fuel load down on the floor that makes it more difficult for the firefighters to get on scene?
That's a loaded question. I don't really know the answer to that question. What I do know comes from the private side, and that is that if you have a wildfire cause a lot of impact on the private sector side, and you have a lot of trees that are damaged or dead, you have a really limited window to try and sell those trees and process those and harvest those trees and get them to market, you know, within months before you start getting, you know, all the beetles and all the other stuff starting to, you know, eat at those trees and reduce their wood quality. And you have to have trucking, you have to have mills that have interest in buying that wood. And then you also have to have, you know, the other elements of other outlets for lower value, you know, materials, and you have to have markets that will even buy that material. So the ability to pivot and move quickly before the wood degrades and to have enough processing sides to be able to handle all that form of biomass is really complicated. And, you know, I look at infrastructure between trucking, processing, manufacturing is being critical to restoration as well as critical to, you know, economic survivability.
And we'll take it from there when we come back.
Hi, my name is Keith Lund. I am an electrician for Owsley Electric. You can go into a trade, be 18, become a trainee. They do require some education. You have 120 hours of classroom education, plus you have to work 2,000 hours a year. So after 4 years, then you can go out and work for another company, getting your own certificate, become your own boss. There's quite a few options you can do.
Own your future and learn more about the Trades Academy at hcoe.org.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:40. We have survived the power cut across for a little bit of work out in the parking lot. Yana's back alongside with us. Yana, what is the situation about prescribed fires? It's something that I think a lot of us remember if we grew up here. It seems pretty straightforward, but is it?
Well, I think the exciting part is that there's a broad recognition that when we sort of eliminated that tool from the toolbox, that had impact. And so there's a great resurgence happening right now, both on the federal side, the state side, and then in the private sector to utilize that tool to both manage fuels, but also for ecosystem benefits and cultural values. And we've developed here in Humboldt County something called the Prescribed Burn Association, which is an organization where neighbors are helping neighbors to be able to implement controlled burns on their properties in partnership with some of the volunteer fire departments as well as some of the fire companies. So it's a training burn and everybody gets skill. And there's getting, you know, more some of the problems with the permitting process for the state are getting ironed out, and so trying to ramp up use of the vegetation management program to be able to do that through CAL FIRE. And, you know, so the idea is that fire is a tool, and under certain conditions that are well thought out in advance and a prescription is written, and if all the boxes are checked yes in the moment and the time, then fire is applied to the landscape in a controlled setting to be able to accomplish objectives.
Now, is a prescribed fire the same thing as a slash burn?
No.
Okay, is it square and rectangle, or are they totally different critters entirely?
Well, I mean, yes, they're both applying fire to the landscape, but pile burns are actually quite tricky, and they produce a lot of smoke, and I think they're necessary, but people aren't always that good at knowing how to construct piles and how to make sure that the moisture is well controlled within them so that they're dry and they don't cause a lot of impact to the community. Where using prescribed fire as a tool is more on the landscape in grasslands and oak woodlands and maybe even into some of the forested environments. I've been involved in a number of projects that are utilizing prescribed fire to control invasive grasses, for example. And it's a very effective tool in managing certain grass species that, you know, have gotten into our landscape and are not of high forage quality and, are difficult to control. But fire actually applied in a late season burn, like in June, is really effective at managing something called Medusa head, for example.
How about bull thistles?
Bull thistles, a little more complicated.
That's kind of like the cockroach of the plant kingdom, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Defensible space as a concept is something that it's being exposed in a lot of different places. For some of us, it doesn't seem practical necessarily, or implementable might be another phrase, as you know, the expanse away from structures is so large. Oftentimes, you know, if it's in a cabin setting, you may not have that much space to be able to get everything away from. So how does that come into this equation about trying to anticipate and perhaps reduce the magnitude of the fires that we are experiencing currently?
Well, defensible space is super important. You know, I used that word continuity earlier, and what defensible space does is it's designed to change the behavior of an oncoming fire, such that if you're using the cabin setting and we're in a forested setting, say, that the fire might move out of the tops of the trees and drop to the ground. And in that case, the cabin can become defendable because the flame heights are such that you could do direct attack on it. If you don't have defensible space, then A, it's not safe for you to be there. B, it might be hard for you to evacuate, and you're likely to lose your home. So the idea of defensible space is really about what you can do, what you can control as a homeowner. And what I'm trying to do in my educational work is get people to think about working from the house outward, because so much of what we're learning is that, you know, what is right around the house, really immediately around the house, is controlling the survival of the home more than anything, or the cabin. So the idea is that if you break up those fuels such that they're more in islands, they don't have the ladders, the shrubs to step up into the crowns, that you can modify fire behavior, you can have a defendable place where you can actually have firefighter response and they'll feel safe in being able to come there. And you might be able to withstand an ember attack where, you know, vegetation that's on fire is thrown at the cabin or the house.
What about things like leaves? I mean, are you recommending that everybody rake all the leaves so that there's less on the ground? And, you know, I look at, yeah, we can use the family place for us. If some of those trees fell, you know, they got on fire and they fell over, they're going from one side of the property to the next. So there literally is no way to, even if all of the vegetation was gone, there's still no way to be able to keep some of the neighboring trees from falling and landing on the buildings themselves.
Well, if your trees are that damaged already and they're likely to fall because of fire, I mean, fire generally is not going to knock a tree over immediately. It may weaken a tree that already has some kind of rot in it or a cavity in it in some way. But just the presence of fire coming through isn't necessarily going to make a healthy tree fall down.
So more like a candle, if you will. It burns in place.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the problem with all those trees is all the litter. So all the leaves and needles and where those fall and whether they land in your gutters, whether they accumulate on your deck, whether they accumulate underneath your deck, around your porch, around your steps. What we're seeing from Paradise is really canopy cover is making a difference in predicting survivability or not. And it's not so much the trees itself, but it's really all that material that they bring down. So, you know, creating some more separation is helpful around the structure. If we're just talking about structures.
Right. So like in the wintertime when, you know, you normally burn off the berries and the low branches that you trim up and all that kind of stuff, put leaves on there also?
Yeah.
Get rid of the leaves.
I mean, pull them away from the house. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last one. We've only got a couple minutes. Biomass. We have talked about the lack of biomass infrastructure in the past.
Yeah.
The fact that it's kind of seen as not only a weak sister, but a weak, ugly, out of town stepsister in the whole concept of renewable energy. Is that moving at all? Is this the opportunity window that's opened to be able to get a couple of those facilities in place and to knock down some of those diseased trees that you were talking about and have somewhere for them to go rather than just lie down there and wait for the next fire?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think here in Humboldt and on the coast where we've had just 10 days of continuous smoke, I mean, I think the air quality impacts of burning all this vegetation are kind of, you know, uncomfortable. And so I would much rather burn up that material in a pollution-controlled facility than in an open pile or in a wildfire, you know, because the amount of black carbon that is emitted during, you know, pile burns or during wildfire is far more than you will ever get out of coming out of a pollution-controlled facility where you can convert that heat into energy. And I just think we have to think about the opportunity because this material is not going away and we have to figure out how to dispose of it some way. And creating energy is a very elegant solution to the challenge.
I would suspect that those facilities are not cheap, but would something like that be logical to put in, like, say, a Humboldt County as part of the whole economic development picture? Can those things get tied back into the power grids quickly and or easily?
They can. I think the biggest challenge is really thinking about siting and having enough industrial facilities to site them. I do think there's opportunity on our old sawmill footprints that, you know, have been dismantled because those are still zoned industrial. We have to be tied into the power grid, and, you know, there's a lot of negotiations that need to happen with Pacific Gas and Electric, and they have to want them, too.
Okay. So I guess that'll be, hopefully we'll have blue skies, and we'll be able to have that as a complete discussion next month. Yeah. Thanks for coming by.
There we go.
All righty.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Blue skies to you. And everybody else, too. Yeah. See you tomorrow.
Yeah.